May it please the court.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Bruce Cohen. I'm here representing the appellants who were the plaintiffs below. In deciding whether the defendants were subject to personal jurisdiction, the court below refused to consider defendants' repeated long-term contacts with the District of Columbia in connection with perpetrating a fraud on the International Trade Commission. This was an error. Both the policy reasons behind the government contacts principle and the case law make it clear the principle is inapplicable here. There are two basic policy reasons for which underlie the government contacts principle. One of them is the First Amendment. Courts are loath to interfere with petitioners' rights to come and petition to petition government agencies or the government in general, and they don't want to discourage the exercise of that right. However, the case law is very clear. There is no right to protection for intentional lies or indeed using government entities to destroy the competition by use of fraud on the government. Based on the August 1999 International Trade Commission decision, which we've included in the appendix and upon which the complaint was based, the background is that the defendants, in order to insulate themselves from foreign competition, decided to defraud the ITC into issuing duties against foreign competitors. Interestingly, no petition was filed against material from Norway, Canada, or Iceland. Those imports were largely controlled by the foreign parents of CC Metals and Elkem. Just as an aside, this fact gives us some understanding of the reason why Elkem and CC Metals did not appear initially as petitioners when it was when the petitions were filed in front of the ITC.
Your submission's based on the idea that there's a fraud exception to the government contacts.
Yes, Your Honor.
Principle. And do we have any D.C. cases saying that?
Yes, Your Honor. First of them, of course, is the Nartex decision.
No, I meant from the D.C. courts, not our court, not the federal court.
Yes, Your Honor. There is a case which, let me apologize at the outset, didn't make it into our briefs, and I'm sorry about that. Mm-hmm. But there is a case, BCCI Holdings versus Khalil, which is found at 20 F Sup 2nd 1. It's a 1997 District of Columbia District decision.
That's again the federal court, right?
That's the federal court.
Yeah, you got the D.C. Court of Appeals.
Yeah.
Has the D.C. Court of Appeals recognized a fraud exception?
Well, I believe that the language in Nartex is a recognition of it.
But that's a federal district court.
No, Your Honor.
It's a federal court, D.C. Circuit.
Oh, your question was
the local courts,
as opposed to the federal courts. I guess what I'll put it all out there. Should we certify this question to the D.C. Court of Appeals, since there seems to be uncertainty in our case law about what the state of D.C. law is on this?
Your Honor, I don't think that's necessary. Federal courts seem to have no problems deciding that.
We said it was uncertain in our case on this. We said it was uncertain.
In our text?
Yeah, that's what we said. We said it was uncertain, and in fact, we said if we had to go one way or the other, we'd go with Lockwood, which was the on-bank that doesn't help you.
Well, Your Honor, I don't read our text that way.
That's what it says. There's no interpretation. It says, were it necessary to determine what law controls today, we would follow Lockwood. Close quote.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Can you point me to the page?
Because it's 786, bottom right.
It's in the briefs.
Yeah, but it's if you've got the Fed Reporter, it's bottom right column, page 786.
And it's referring to the D.C. Court of Appeals in-bank decision in Lockwood. So it's looking to the D.C. Court of Appeals for an answer.
Take my word for it.
Okay.
It's there.
I was reading it, okay? It's there. Doesn't require any interpretation.
I just off the top of my head, without looking at it, Your Honor, I believe that that they weren't really talking about whether there was a fraud exception. I think that there was, wasn't there a...
You asking me now?
No, I'm suggesting, Your Honor, that there was some dispute as to whether under environmental there would be a First Amendment policy basis for it, or whether it was just making the court into a national jurisdiction. But in fact, the way the court said reads it to me is, at 787, a different case might be presented had Nartex made credible and specific allegations in the district court that the companies had used the proceedings as an instrumentality of the alleged fraud. And in fact,
and the key word there is might.
Well, Your Honor, yes.
Said would, then.
Well, I mean, the district court has interpreted that as dicta. I read it as...
It's classic dicta.
As technical dicta, but what they're basically saying is there has been no showing here that there was fraud used on an instrumentality of the government to achieve the end. And frankly...
Look, here's your problem. Yes. Look, here's why Judge Kavanaugh asked about certification and why I do too. You've got a D.C. Court of Appeals on-bank decision refusing to hold that the government contacts exception is First Amendment based, and you've got two subsequent panel decisions finding that it is.
Yes, but Your Honor, I don't think
don't we have to certify it under those circumstances?
No, Your Honor, because I don't think that the policy basis, whichever policy basis there is for the government contacts principle, whether it be the First Amendment issue, which I started to address, or the other policy basis, which is don't want to make the District of Columbia a national forum, it doesn't matter here. What is at issue here is if there is a government contacts principle to be applied because the government has been petitioned by some citizen or even a foreigner, is there an exception when that instrumentality of the fraud is the government agency?
And the exception you're looking for is based on the First Amendment, right?
No, it doesn't matter, Your Honor. It could be either one. Mm-hmm. And we made very clear that no matter which one that you use, it doesn't matter here because there is no privilege under the First Amendment for fraud, and this exception will not swamp the District of Columbia. The reason that I say that...
Why not? Because won't it be easy to allege fraud in cases and really get around the government contacts?
No, Your Honor, because I think you have to really look at the language that the court, that the panel in Nartex used. It says you have to make credible and specific allegations in the district court. You can't just come in and say... Notice pleading.
Under, allegations.
Right. You have to have much more, and that's what we have here. We have not only credible and specific information, we have the findings of the International Trade Commission that these defendants came to them, filed fraudulent petitions, supplied fraudulent information, and caused them to issue dumping duties, which when they found out about the fraud, the ITC went back and said those duties would never have been applied if it were not for the fraud perpetrated by the defendants.
And what decision of the D.C. Court of Appeals supports what you just said?
Nartex, Your Honor.
That's the federal court.
That's us.
Oh, the federal court.
In other words, you're relying on a D.C. statute, all right, for basis of personal jurisdiction.
I am.
All right, so the question is, how does the highest court in the District of Columbia interpret that language? And Judge Tatel referred to two different decisions by that court. And the question is, all you have is us saying we're on clear, but when in doubt, we would follow the in-bank decision, and you would lose.
No, Your Honor, because the question that was in front of those two courts is not the question which is in front of this court. The question...
The difference is you're saying that you have a federal agency opinion finding that the petitioners came before it and made fraudulent statements in support of their petitions. So you have very strong evidence of fraud.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. But the question is, would the D.C. Court of Appeals back off or change its view of its concern about D.C. not becoming a national forum?
Well, I don't think so. And
but you don't think so. How do we know that?
What I was about to say is, in the back of my mind, there is, and I'm sorry I didn't think of this question before, but in the back of my mind, in one of the cases that we've cited, is a citation to a D.C. Circuit non-federal court.
D.C. Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Your Honor. D.C. Court of Appeals. I'm not from here, and okay. I have a problem with that. The D.C. Court of Appeals, which recognizes, I believe recognizes a fraud exception. And the there have been a number of federal courts, as we've shown, which
okay, have, but I think the case that's cited in your brief is a federal district court case. I agree. District is confusing in this jurisdiction, but we're trying to talk about the state court system. All right. Has the state court system said anything about this fraud exception?
I can't stand here, Your Honor, and cite you to a case,
right,
but I believe that in this.
So
in
why are you resisting certification? Doesn't it make sense for all of us to find out what the court that actually has responsibility for resolving this issue? Tell us what the answer is.
Well, there are a number of reasons. One, I think that this court is perfectly competent to decide.
But you can't even cite us a D.C. Court of Appeals case that supports your position.
Well, I'm standing here, Your Honor.
How are we going to be sure about it if
well,
you can't tell us what it is?
Yeah, there are other district courts, Your Honor, who have gone along, and frankly, every court that has...
This is the D.C. Court of Appeal. This is the D.C. Circuit here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. We're not bound by district court decisions.
No, Your Honor, you certainly are.
In fact, we're reviewing one here.
Right? Yes, you are.
Okay.
And
so,
frankly,
and you agree that the law here is determined by the D.C. Court of Appeals, right? Right?
The issue of whether something is procedural or is substantive and whether the federal court is competent to do it, it was not something that I thought about. But frankly, there's a Second Circuit case which indicates in New York, class action rules, you know, can't be, well, let me strike that.
All right. Why don't we hear our counsel for appellee? Give you a few minutes. Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Dale Hershey.
What do you think about certification?
Certification might be a sensible way to solve this. I think neither Mr. Cohen nor I had thought very seriously about certification until it came up this morning, a brilliant idea. I note that as to certification, Mr. Cohen submitted a case after he submitted his brief. It came from the District of Georgia. I frankly don't recall the name of that case, but he submitted only the district court opinion. The district court opinion was appealed. The appellate court, federal appellate court, determined that because the question of fraud was an issue, and it was an issue under Georgia state law, this happened to be a diversity case, the case should be referred back to the Georgia Supreme Court for a decision as to whether fraud is an exception under Georgia law. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the Georgia Supreme Court found that it is not an exception. The federal appellate court then did not recognize fraud as an exception, and the case ended. Since we do not have authoritative statements from the D.C. Court of Appeals, or as far as I'm aware, even D.C. trial courts on this subject, we're treading here without the benefit of that learning. The plaintiff seeks the opportunity to file a claim in the district court with what we believe to be inadequate personal jurisdiction for a variety of reasons pointed out by the trial court judge. And this fraud exception seems to be the focus of the appellant's point of view. that if you defraud a federal agency, you don't get the benefit of a government contacts exception. And that oversimplifies the whole case. If you look at who the parties here really are, in fact, only one of the defendants was a petitioner. Only one of the defendants filed a petition, which the International Trade Commission later found to contain material that was misleading. And that particular defendant, Aimcor, has been released from the case by the plaintiff, or really by the International Trade Commission, which in its August, in a later finding, declared that Aimcor had no knowledge of any conspiracy to defraud the ITC. So then that lets Aimcor out. Then there are a couple foreign parents of domestic companies. What connection do they have with this district? The district court, reviewing the evidence carefully, came to the conclusion that there is a lack of showing of control by those foreign corporations, and therefore, whatever the domestic subsidiaries are doing, we're not going to pierce the corporate veil and make those foreign parents liable or rope them into jurisdiction in this court. The remaining defendants did not file petitions. Elkem did not file a petition with the International Trade Commission. CCMA, or as was then known as SKW, did not file a petition with the with the International Trade Commission. So what you have here is a group of defendants who are in different situations, and as to each of them, the district court has analyzed their tie to the jurisdiction under considering both the government contacts approach and the District of Columbia's long-arm statute, and it finds the plaintiff's allegations inadequate as to both those approaches. The appellant really points to no serious inadequacy in the analysis made by the district court judge of this evidence about how present they were in the district. Furthermore, the appellant took discovery on the subject of jurisdiction. So they tried to investigate what the facts might be that would disclose a tie between these various defendants and this district. And there were responses to that discovery, and even analyzing what that discovery disclosed, the district court found that there was inadequate contact in light of all of those facts. And these are, of course, circumstances under which the district court is not bound by allegations. The district court looks to the evidence that is presented and weighs the evidence. So it's our position that the district court is correct, that there is no personal jurisdiction here, that and even as to the issue of fraud, the defendants in the case, the appellees here, have consistently denied that they in fact did defraud the International Trade Commission. The evidence shows that if you look at the market for ferrosilicon, an analysis of the market shows that there was no impact of any price conspiracy on this product. That really is an issue in a different forum that goes to the merits of this case. I think as far as we are concerned, the district court's opinion is sound.
What about, assuming you're right on the no personal jurisdiction issue, the transfer question?
Well,
why not transfer rather than dismiss? Because they're going to be out of time otherwise, and that would seem to be contrary to the interests of justice.
Well, a plaintiff has an opportunity to locate a district in which all of the defendants can be found. And that's the district in which the plaintiff
isn't
should...
the Western District of Pennsylvania such a district?
No, it apparently is not. For
why do you
example,
say apparently?
Well, the defendant Evonik is not in the District of Western District of Pennsylvania, has never been there, and is in no way tied to that district. So
the district court didn't do that analysis, right? The district court stopped at an earlier stage and said that there hasn't been sufficient suggestion of where to transfer, so I'm not even going to consider the individual defendants. Right?
That's correct. There was no defendant-by-defendant analysis at that point. But the candidacy...
Doesn't it make sense, given that they'll be out of time, to have such a defendant-by-defendant analysis before their case would be extinguished?
Well, if there were a defendant-by-defendant analysis, I can represent to the court that Evonik is not... in the Western District of Pennsylvania.
That's what all appellate lawyers
yes.
say. We have district courts to get answers to questions like that.
Disappointed if you didn't think you'd win. But
We have had go-rounds in the Western District of Pennsylvania on this whole matter.
Our job would be a lot easier if we just accepted those assurances.
So your point in part is that even that were there a fraud exception, there'd be no jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear.
As I understand, your argument is, and this is not exactly as you put it, but were we to certify this to the D.C. Court of Appeals, it might determine that there was no basis for jurisdiction and therefore no basis for it to reach the question of whether there is a fraud exception. Is that what you're suggesting?
That is a possibility, yes. Mm-hmm. Because of the failure to satisfy the requirements of the long-arm statute.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Anything further?
No.
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Counsel for appellant?
Your Honors, very quickly, on transfer, Evonik, as we understand it, is the successor to SKW AG, I believe it was, which was the foreign parent of what is now CC Metals, and was a defendant in the underlying price-fixing conspiracy on inter alia ferrosilicon, and was in the case throughout
in
the Western District of Pennsylvania, Your Honor. With respect to Elkem and CC Metals not signing the petition, I had started to get into that.
On that transfer question, the district court's analysis was that you hadn't identified a particular district, and so why should the district court go through the steps when you hadn't met your burden of identifying a district that would be appropriate?
Well, Your Honor, she understood us to say that the Western District of Pennsylvania was appropriate because, in her opinion, she said she referenced that. Mm-hmm. And we did, in our briefs, point out that the Western District of Pennsylvania was an appropriate place and that CC Metals...
It doesn't say that. It doesn't identify the Western District of Pennsylvania.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, she talked about, she knew that we had asked for it. Our briefs below identified the Western District of Pennsylvania because we referenced the fact that CC Metals' brief below had referenced the Western District of Pennsylvania. We pointed out that even the defendants agreed that there was a place where jurisdiction would have been appropriate.
Yeah, it's not quite as specific as you're suggesting there, but that I'll leave it there for now. That's okay.
Anything further?
Yes, Your Honor. Just with respect to Elkem and CC Metals, their parents imported materials from Iceland, Norway, and Canada. Those countries were not named in any petitions. It would have looked very strange for their domestic subsidiaries to be signing petitions against everybody else's ferrosilicon coming in except theirs. So they had their unions front for them. When the ITC decided to revisit the issue after the fraud came out, Elkem and CC Metals were in the forefront of 8 years of attempting to delay, destroy, undercut the ITC. They were the active participants. Elkem itself financed most of the effort, according to the King deposition. With respect to Amcor, the subsequent decision, it didn't say that there was no evidence. It said that the original opinion referenced evidence of their knowledge of the conspiracy and their fraud. Subsequently, Amcor filed an affidavit trying to counter that, and they basically said, we're in a position of a court trying to grant summary judgment when there's a dispute of facts, and therefore we can't say with assurance that they knew about the conspiracy. But that, I think, is a merits question as to whether they knew about the conspiracy, whether they themselves, Amcor, defrauded the ITC. With respect to the foreigners, I'll just leave it in the brief and say that any foreign corporation which can get its domestic subsidiaries to engage in a price-fixing conspiracy, force its employees to face jail and fines, is sufficiently in control of that domestic subsidiary as to warrant saying that they're just the agent. And with respect to whether or not there was was actually fraud, the defendants have always said no. The ITC has always said yes, there was. And ultimately that was affirmed after 7.5 or 8 years of appeals to the Court of International Trade, back and forth, remand petitions. They were constantly in the District of Columbia in front of the ITC trying to maintain their fraud and their ability to destroy the foreign competitors' business in the U.S., which they did.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the case under advisement.